This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Have you ever been mid-flight and there's been an incident and as a result the plane has been turned around or it's had to make an emergency landing? So how were you told? What was the reaction from other passengers? How did you react and how did the crew handle it? What training goes into relaying information when a plane does have to be turned around, like what we saw over the weekend? We'll speak to a former airline captain in just a moment about how they navigate that.
On 774 ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Rochelle Hunt.
So if a plane gets turned around mid-flight, how are you informed? Are you informed? And how much training goes into that? Michelle Huntington, former airline captain and author of Lady MacGyver, Unbelievable Stories with Altitude. Michelle, there's how the world reacted when we saw flights turned around and returned to their home airport, when we saw entire airspace just cleared, like looking at some of those screens and the little yellow aeroplanes was unbelievable. But then there's how you and other pilots would have reacted to this news. What happens when you're told to turn the plane around?
Hi, Rochelle. Look, when we're told to turn the plane around, we have checklists to do that. So we're given as much information as possible from the air traffic control and our company. And that's what we need to rely on. They're our ears and eyes on the ground. We are, if we're mid-flight, we don't know what's happened necessarily with internet, et cetera, on board. You know, passengers may be aware of disrupt and things happening before we are, but we have to trust and we're trained to trust air traffic control and the operations centre for the airline that you work with.
So you're not always told exactly the reason why?
Not initially. If it's an immediate action, it's just turn here and head to here. You know, we'll inform you next after you've done that. So yeah. If you've got to think, they're trying to reroute as many aircraft as possible in a short amount of time.
So if you've got passengers jumping onto Google, surely you've got crew and you've got pilots doing that as well? Or no, are you a little more restrained than the rest of us?
Look, we are restrained. Mind you, sometimes passengers show the cabin crew who then show us. But we know that humans crave certainty and need information. And as soon as you don't have that, then, you know, you can go down a rabbit hole of, my goodness, what's happening? So we try and find out as much information. And if we can't, we actually tell the passengers, look, we've been told to turn around. We'll get back to you when we find out more.
And I guess if you don't tell them that you're turning around, people would twig, I guess. I mean, can you, as a passenger, depending on whether you're asleep or not, but you would know if the plane has been turned around?
I think a lot of regular flyers would, and depends on how quickly the aircraft's turned. If it's a slow turn, some people don't even realise, and I see them if I'm travelling in the back, they're not even realising we're in a holding pattern going round and round in circles. So some people may not know, except for things like, you know, the sun's not rising where they thought it would, or they're not seeing a lake that they usually fly over, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. Michelle, stay with us. Michelle Huntington is with you, former airline captain. But Coralie, is in Oakley. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's your story?
Oh, mid-1970s, Qantas, Rome to Melbourne, and a laconic Australian pilot voice came over. We've been flying due north to Belgrade for the last hour due to some trouble on the border between Turkey and Greece, but we'll try to make up time. The plane did 90-degree turn, opened the throttle, and my God, I thought the wings had fallen off.
Oh, really? So you could feel the difference?
oh my gosh, yes, it's speed.
how was, because back then, Coralie, like Michelle and I have been talking about, you wouldn't have had the internet. So you just trust what you're told. But what was kind of the vibe on the plane? Were people edgy? Were people calm?
No, not at all. Well, I'm a panic flyer. I had the menu out trying to calculate what extra time, because in those days, dangerous to have a jumbo up over 10 hours. And I had the horrors.
Yeah.
And they also said, well, you know, when we get to the North Australian airways, we'll pick up the the winds from there, and we hope to get in on time.
And the idea of you had the horrors, that's exactly what it is. And I do wonder, Michelle, how you tell people, how much information you tell people, keeping passengers and crew calm. That must be important.
Yeah, we're trained that when you speak to passengers, that you speak to them as you would any loved one that you have, you know, you hold close to you. So you give them the information in a way that they can understand, not technical jargon to confuse them, etc. And just let them know, you know, what's happened, what that means for them, and what we're going to do.
Judy's in Don Vale. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning.
What's your story? I'm bracing myself for all of these stories, by the way. What's yours?
About 2016, I was flying from Montreal, where I'd had a lengthy stopover, to Halifax in Nova Scotia. And it became more and more cloudy as we progressed towards, and we get to where we're expecting to land. And the captain's voice comes over the airwaves and says, "Now, ladies and gentlemen, we can't find the airport."
Nope.
Some of the most unfortunate ways of communicating, I thought. And he said it again. He said, "We'll circle round once more, and if we still can't find the airport and Moncton to the north is in the same conditions, we'll fly back to Montreal." Well, weren't there people on the plane who knew better, who had appointments, executives of companies? And I'm sitting there quietly on my own, and I must have smiled at the air hostess, and she said, and I said, "I've been sitting here thinking, thank goodness it's Air Canada. They'll have enough fuel, and the terrain round here is fairly flat." And yes, we flew all the way back the 4 hours or so to Montreal.
It's funny, Judy, that you mentioned people saying, I have appointments. And, you know, I was listening to our rolling coverage on the ABC as the strikes on Iran started to play out in real time. And, Michelle, there are always people that get upset that, you know, they wanted to make it to their mum's 90th or whatever it may be, and now that their flight's been cancelled. However, you don't turn planes around. You don't shut down three of the world's busiest airports for no reason, and if passengers' safety wasn't paramount. I just wonder whether passengers are the worst sometimes and quite selfish.
Oh, look, you can understand because, and I was saying to your producer earlier, you know, we are the centre of our own universe and, you know, it's everything's happening for us. So when it doesn't go to plan, we feel a bit out of control and don't often take a step back and think about the bigger picture. So we do empathise. And there was a time when I flew an aircraft of people to Ballina when on the ground, the electrical thing connection that we to make us be able to start the aircraft again once we'd shut it down wasn't working. So we flew that whole, after landing, taxiing to the bay, we weren't able to shut down. We had to then fly back to Sydney and we had a wedding party on board.
Oh, no.
And it was horrible. We felt so much for the passengers, but, you know, they got up there the next flight, but it was heartbreaking for us to have to do it as well.
And I wonder how much information to give. Ken in Caulfield says, you know, he was flying from Hong Kong to LA. It was the late 90s. The 747 lost one engine and the captain came over the PA and explained that we were early into the flight. The plane couldn't make it with three engines. He said that they'd looked at landing in Osaka. The airport was the closest. Sort of goes on, but he'd made that return trip to Hong Kong. Like, you know what? I wouldn't want to know that we were flying on three engines. I would prefer to be
you
naive
prefer,
there.
Like, technical issue.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Do you give all of the details all of the time?
No, because it does cause unnecessary stress and worry in people. Like, so a technical issue, you know, we aren't able to continue and we have to return is enough information. If, however, there's smoke and fire, not addressing that is kind of remiss.
If there is smoke and fire.
It's on fire.
I'm already panicking, right? That's absolutely a given. Just finally, Michelle, because we're going to have a chat with the insurance council in just a moment, because people will be thinking, okay, wow, I'm traveling to Europe in the next 3 or 4 weeks. What do I do? Should I cancel my flight? Should I not cancel my flight? We have got 3 of the busiest airports in the world shut down for goodness knows how long right now. How can international air travel cope without these Middle Eastern airports up and running? I mean, COVID taught us a lot. We shut down air travel altogether, but how do you envisage this playing out over the next week or two?
I think because of the COVID issues with air travel stopped, we learnt a lot. And so having different hubs set up and, you know, we're pretty resilient crew aviation. So I think they'll very quickly plan other options. And so once the other 3 hubs get up and running, it'll be an easy transition back into it. But I know that there are currently, you know, in the back rooms, things happening to make sure people can get as close as they can to where they initially wanted to.
Michelle, always good to get your thoughts. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Rochelle.
Michelle Huntington, former airline captain, author of Lady MacGyver, Unbelievable Stories with Altitude. Wow, some interesting messages. Joe says, last time airspace was closed over the Middle East was when Israel was sending missiles. I left Rome on a Tuesday and arrived back in Melbourne on Saturday. Wow, we diverted to Istanbul, Doha, 24 hours in transit lounge. Wowee, that's from Joe, who's in Hawthorne. Well, if you are flying anytime soon, or maybe you've had flights cancelled and you've got insurance questions, then you're in luck. Andrew Hall joining us in just a moment, Executive Director of the Insurance Council of Australia. Goodness gracious, some of the messages coming in about why and how planes have been turned around over the years in mid-air emergencies. A lot of them in the 70s, just quietly. You never forget, do you? Gosh, I wouldn't. Late 70s, San Fran to Melbourne. Routine stop in Honolulu to refuel, pick up passengers. Departing Honolulu, there was a very loud noise, like an explosion. Cabin went quiet. No announcement. The plane started circling. We could smell kerosene. After at least half an hour, the pilot announced that we'd blown a tyre, we had to dump fuel, and we had to return to Honolulu for an emergency landing. Oh, keep these coming through. But as we were saying, the closure of pretty much the world's busiest international airports, that's been a massive disruption to travel plans for people all around the world. So if you've got travel coming up, if you're travelling to Europe, if you're travelling to the Middle East, where do you stand? Are you allowed to cancel, postpone your flights? Andrew Hall, Executive Director of the Insurance Council of Australia. Andrew, I mean, does travel insurance generally can be tricky and complicated? And for many of us, we think we're covered until we're not. At the moment, what is the main top line piece of advice you're giving?
Well, good morning, Michelle. Obviously, at the moment, it's a very uncertain period and it's a very serious period. It is involving acts of war and the like, and that is probably one of the most serious things you can confront when you're travelling. And we know we've got lots of Australians that are that use the Middle East corridor to get to and from Europe. So there are a lot of people that are currently disrupted. I think the main thing with travel insurance to understand is that while it covers most things that can happen to you, medical emergencies or delays, lost luggage and the like, war and terrorism acts are generally excluded across the vast majority of travel insurance products. So it means what we need to think about is, I guess there's a couple of different groups of people at the moment. Mm. You've got those that are in transit at the moment. And they're in the care of their airline, and they need to be, you know, at first point in talking to their airline about what the options are for getting them to their final destination. And I think the airlines are doing the right thing at the moment. I can see that the major airlines through the Middle East are offering people the ability to rebook or refund. And if you can do that and you can secure a seat on an alternative airline, that's the most sensible thing to do. Then you have, I guess, people who are caught in transit and are in the war zone as it is. And we've got to remember the United Arab Emirates, Qatar and the like have declared war. And there are missiles and drones striking key infrastructure there at the moment. So it's a very unsafe place to be. We are working closely with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. It is the Australian government's directions and orders that we need to follow here. When they place a do not travel order in place for a country, that generally removes it from an insurance policy. So people should know they shouldn't be travelling there until those orders are lifted. So even though we are starting to see in the last hour or so, I noticed that there are some flights starting to operate in and out of Abu Dhabi, for example. I would consider it very carefully whether or not the government is lifting the do not travel advice. And then you've got people with future travel plans. The airlines are offering windows of cancellation and refund, and you should talk to the airline first about what your options are. There are some travel insurance policies that usually the premium level policy will have a cancel for any reason clause. Often you can use those clauses to cancel your future bookings because you can just say, I've changed my mind. I don't want to fly on that airline. I don't want to fly through there. I don't want to take that holiday. So I guess there are various cohorts, but the most important piece of message at the moment is if you're in transit, you need to be in contact with the consulate with Smart Traveller and keep an eye closely on what the airline is telling you.
Andrew, I'm trying to remember now whether it was the Prime Minister or if it was Penny Wong that was saying that they would be relying on commercial airlines in order to either get people home or to get them to a safe place or to reroute them in some way. At what point, and this is different depending on whether you have Australian citizens living in some of the affected areas or whether you have travellers who are stuck in some of the areas, would the role of kind of DFAT come into this and repatriation flights kick in any way? Is that possible?
Well, once you have a situation of a theatre of war and there's live military activity impacting a place, at that point, this is a sovereign risk. This is a government issue completely. I think what the minister was saying this morning, and she is right, with the vast number of people that would need to be moved, you really need the commercial airlines to get operating again. These are airlines with large A380s. They're huge airlines. They're some of the biggest in the world. And we're going to need to see those aircraft moving those people. I don't think Australia is going to be able to get military aircraft in to move the sort of passengers that were needed to be moved. So let's hope over the next coming 24, 48 hours that those movements can commence. But this very much will need to be a government-coordinated movement.
And it may be for weeks. Maybe, I mean, this is something that may go for weeks, if not longer. I also wonder if, and I'm going to simplify this question, Andrew, so excuse me here, but let's say you are flying to the UK or to Europe in the next couple of weeks, but you're feeling really nervous about it now, so you want to either postpone or you want to cancel your flight. Is that enough of an excuse to say, look, I don't feel safe doing this. I'd like to do it at another time. Does that hold up?
Yes. So it depends on the policy that you have. There are a number of policies you can purchase, which are generally marketed at a premium end. They offer cancel for any reason. So if you've looked into and looked for a policy that gives you that flexibility, you should have a conversation with your travel insurer. The travel insurers are fielding a lot of calls at the moment and are very happy to support those customers if they want to think about what options are available to them. I think in the first instance, the travel insurer will ask you as well, what is the airline offering? Because as I said, the airlines are now offering these windows. Some of them are going out to the 6th or 7th of March and others where you can change or cancel for free. And so I think people should, first of all, use websites to look at the airlines or speak to their travel agent to see what flexibility they're being offered in that regard before they make those decisions. But yes, you can have travel policies, and there are many in the market that do offer cancel for any reason.
Andrew Hall is with you, Executive Director of the Insurance Council of Australia. A couple of questions that have come through on text. Good morning. This war is just not good, and if you're travelling later and have travel insurance, it's better to let the airline and the travel agent cancel, as I understand that war is not covered in travel insurance. So that's, I guess, what you're alluding to, Andrew, is that it is best for your travel agent to do it if you have a travel agent, because for many of us, we don't now. We do it all ourselves, don't we?
That's right. But, I mean, you can still talk to your travel insurer about if you have issues. You may need issues in terms of medical care or the like. There may be other costs that you can claim for. So, but in the first instance, when it comes to actually just the transportation component and you're in transit, at this point, but the airline and the government channels are the most authoritative places to be going to and getting that advice from.
What about accommodation? Are we covered for accommodation in any way?
Again, if the disruption is caused by war or terrorism, it may be excluded. If you're in the care of the airline in transit, the airline in some cases may be taking care of people's accommodation. But this is where it does become a challenge for governments, where governments need to know where their citizens are, who's looking after them and how they're going to evacuate them.
1300 222 774. You can text 0437 774 774. This question or point: what's happening with the reinstatement of the Travellers Guarantee Fund to protect consumers? Is there any comment you can make to that, Andrew?
I'm not quite sure what they're referring to, whether that was related to the airline collapse period, you know, when after Ansett and we had all those dramas. Perhaps that's what that person's referring to. So I don't think that's something that's contemplated or needed for the time being. I think the airlines that are involved in this scenario are all government-owned to start with. So I think that there will be deep pockets funding these closures and these shutdowns. I don't know whether that is a scenario that we need to contemplate at the moment.
So should people just finally, Andrew, for those who are maybe travelling in the next couple of weeks, maybe in a month, is it better, like, should you just sit, hold tight, wait and see, or should you be contacting airlines, travel agents, insurance companies?
Well, number one, I wish I had a crystal ball, Michelle. I'd love to give you that answer and tell you that it's all going to be okay. I think it all depends on your risk appetite. I think it also depends on the information that becomes available over the next 24, 48 hours in terms of that region. It's obviously a region that's critically important, not just for travellers, but for world trade. A lot of our goods and services, our marine traffic is coming through that area. We know last time the region was disrupted, we saw a flow-on impact on things like imported car parts. A whole raft of things get impacted when that region is closed like this. So I think for the well-being of everyone, not the least the people who live in that area,
Absolutely.
Let's hope there is a resolution.
Andrew, thank you for your time. I know how busy you are at the moment.
Thank you, Rochelle. My pleasure.
Andrew Hall, Executive Director of the Insurance Council of Australia. Some of the most incredible messages coming in talking about when your plane has been turned around, or just how your pilot or cabin crew let you know about some sort of mid-air emergency. Flying with my 12-year-old daughter home to Melbourne after a cousin's wedding in London. 4 hours into the flight, we had to turn back to Heathrow due to a passenger who was ill. It was chaos back at Heathrow. 2 a.m., no staff at the airport, just lots of tired, confused passengers. We were told nothing. Many hours later, we got on a plane again, bound for home. After takeoff, the pilot said, "Sorry, thank you for your patience." The entire plane clapped loudly. It seems we'd just been waiting for a sorry and an acknowledgement of what we'd been through. All the passengers were great. Nobody got upset. We were probably just too tired. We got home 24 hours after we should have, but we were safe and sound.
On 774 ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Rochelle Hunt.
You can also keep your mid-air emergency calls coming through. If you've been on a plane that's been turned around for one reason, how was it dealt with? What were you told? You can text that through. But there have been disruptions to airports and to airlines all around the world. We've seen images of people sleeping at airports. You may have loved ones who are stuck in transit at the moment, who are looking for accommodation. And it's affecting pretty much anything and everything, including the Formula One. So the Grand Prix is on this weekend. There were reports that McLaren and Mercedes had staff members who were stuck in Bahrain and were trying to get some of those members home. Ned Hall from ABC Sport. Ned, I mean, it's not just the Grand Prix that looks like it's being impacted. There's heaps of other sports, but I know the Grand Prix has come out and said, nothing to see here, don't worry, everyone and everything we need is here, but whether or not we believe that is another thing. Are there still members from different teams stuck in transit, do you know?
Look, I'd have thought that there would be, because not everyone would have been in Melbourne, the full week in advance from the racing actually starting. But a week out from the racing, a fair proportion would have been, and a fair proportion of the important equipment would already have made its way to Australia. I think it probably also underlines how important that sort of central hub around the Middle East has become now for travel. So much goes through there, from northern hemisphere to southern hemisphere, even east to west. A lot goes through there now. And so with this incident taking place in and around Iran, and then the countries that are impacted by it as well, it is definitely, without doubt, going to have a huge impact on travel plans going through that region.
So just on F1 still for the moment, I mean, there's people, but then what about, I don't know, equipment, tyres, microphones? Like, could you imagine that there would still be important pieces of machinery in transit? Or would that all have been here well and truly in advance?
I think most of the key stuff would pretty much already be here. But I'd also think that, you know, with the Formula One, they've got deep pockets. And yeah, I think a lot of them have their own private mechanisms for transport as well. Yes. So they're basically able to ship things through themselves and probably avoid the worst of the knock-on effect and the impact from this. I'd have thought a lot of the media who might be travelling out here would be affected by it, would
That's
be making
true.
Alternative arrangements at the moment, because a lot of them wouldn't have been spending the full week here ahead of the Grand Prix. But I think there's a lot of people scrambling around and probably making slight changes to their plans at the moment to try and make sure that they can get to Melbourne in time for all the action kicking off later this week.
So in terms of it being kind of F1 season globally at the moment, Bahrain is due, I think, on the 12th of April to host their race, Saudi Arabia on the 19th of April. I guess two things there. Could you, again, I know it's crystal balling, but could you imagine those events going ahead? And could Melbourne host Bahrain, for example?
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it, because I think if they're not going to go ahead with those Grand Prix, and I could definitely see a scenario where they don't race in those countries. I mean, it would seem a little foolish to go and take everything over there at the moment to try and race when there is a genuine threat of bombs falling around them, that they would be looking maybe to hold the races in alternative locations. Albert Park's already set up at the moment, and obviously they'd be going through the process of breaking it all down, but they might actually say to them, do you mind keeping things as they are for the coming weeks? In between that, they go to China the following weekend after the Australian Grand Prix, and they're in Japan at the end of the month, so they were the other Grand Prix there, and the other side of that, it goes into North America, Miami, and then Canada. So I think there'll be some preference to try and keep it in the Asian sphere and keep it in sort of, whether it is going back to China or Japan or even coming back to Melbourne. And I know a lot of the drivers love racing in Melbourne as well. So I think that would be a preference for them, would to be to come out to Melbourne if those Grand Prix didn't go ahead.
Ned Hall is with you from ABC Sport. Ned, we are broadcasting on the ABC Listen Sport app, the Women's Asian Cup at the moment. It's underway as we speak. Now, Australia is due to play Iran this coming Thursday, but I think they're playing tonight. Correct me if I'm wrong. But this is causing, is it causing any complications in any way for players?
Look, I think it's an interesting one. So Iran first qualified for the Women's Asian Cup in 2022, and it was being heralded as a big step forward at that time in terms of women's sport coming out of Iran and actually making it to a major tournament. Obviously, things have shifted a fair bit over those last 4 years, and I don't think a lot of the players want to speak out about it. However, as you have to do at these major tournaments, Iran did hold a press conference yesterday before the match they're playing against Korea tonight, and they were asked about the impact of what's taking place in their country.
Ali Khamenei, the leader of Islamic Republic, has been killed. The president of United States and the global media, including Australian Prime Minister, confirmed the news. People inside and outside Iran are expressing great joy over this news. I would like to know your feeling at this moment regarding the killing of Ali Khamenei before your matches with South Korea and during this tournament. Thank you.
Okay, I think that's all for your question. Thank you for asking, but let's just focus on the game itself. Thank you very much.
Wow, I wonder whether that question will get asked again. I mean they're in the tournament, right? And they're going to have press conferences between now and next Thursday.
You know, the really difficult thing for them is I suspect that, as I say, the regime in Iran probably weren't great supporters of the Iranian women's national football team.
No.
I don't think they would be too upset about the regime change over there. However, with family back home in Iran, I don't think you'll see them speak out an awful lot and say much about the subject at all, because they'll know exactly that. In the past, in the 2022 Men's World Cup, the Iranian men's national team refused to sing the national anthem, and there was talk of sanctions being made against them and their family members as a result of that, as protesting against the government in their own country. So it's a very delicate situation for them, because you can probably sense that they'd be quite pleased with what's happening back in Iran, but they will not feel comfortable speaking out about it. A couple of players have actually pulled out of the squad before this had happened, knowing the unrest that was taking place in their country. And a lot of that was due to, I think, just sort of struggling to go through playing in a tournament when their family might be, you know, experiencing difficulties back at home.
And, I mean, there's just so many different sports that are impacted in some way. So the FIFA World Cup in the United States, what will happen there? Because FIFA has said it will kind of monitor developments from this conflict, but is expected that the Iranian national team actually won't be allowed to the US.
Well, and that's from probably both sides. I don't know that the Iranians would want to go and would be happy with their team going and playing a tournament in the United States. And I think it's always been an issue. Would the US allow Iranian players to come in? Now, if you look through the teams at the World Cup and you do a quick cross-reference with teams that are on the Trump administration's visa freeze as well, for whether they're allowing people to come in the country, a fair crossover there. There's a lot of countries who have qualified for this World Cup who, if you're a regular citizen, you would not get into the United States. I think there's maybe, being a little cynical here, if Gianni Infantini, one of the reasons behind his peace prize, the award to Donald Trump, was to try and smooth the way over some of that, to allow teams and officials to go into the USA without too much hindrance. But there'll definitely be some issues with teams trying to get into the US, whether they'll be allowed in. And I certainly think Iran at the moment, there seems very unlikely that they'll be taking part in this World Cup. But it's a few months away yet, and there's a lot of bridges to be crossed in terms of organising what happens there if the current regime is completely out and it's a new Iran that comes in there afterwards. They may be welcomed into the United States, but as I say, there's a lot of other countries that at the moment may not be.
Gosh, it just shows you how much sports people travel, because I was also reading that there was a group of tennis players, I think, stranded in Dubai as well. So whether or not that impacts the Dubai championships, but cricket is being impacted as well. I think the women's squad is in Abu Dhabi.
Yes, they are. And also there's an England Lions team out there at the moment. And Johnny Bairstow, who Australian cricket fans will know very well from controversial incidents in the Ashes a few years ago, tweeted Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, to get them out of there from a tournament they're having over there. So there's a lot of players obviously either go through there or are playing events there at the moment. I was on Offsiders yesterday with Tess Madgen, the Opals basketball player. She's travelling with the Opals to Turkey this week, where they've got a World Cup qualifier, and they again are due to be travelling through Doha on the way to Turkey. So the knock-on effect from what's happening there is huge. As I say, a lot of people will be scrambling to make alternative arrangements, but even, you know, Turkey borders Iran, so whether or not events will be able to take place there or not, or whether they'll have to be shifted. I know obviously this is the lower end of the scale around this conflict, but
of course
the knock-on effect from all these things is enormous over what's happening in so many different events. events over the next few months.
It's funny, this text says maybe Adelaide can steal the Grand Prix.
I'm sure they'll be terrible. I'm sure they'll be thinking about it as well. Well, they're getting themselves set up for it. I'm not sure they're in place to do it yet, but I'm sure they'll have the hand up, no question.
Oh, Ned, thank you. And of course, ABC Sport will be broadcasting the Women's Asian Cup live and every match on the ABC Sport Listen app. Ned, thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Cheers.
Ned Hall, a part of our ABC Sports team. We've been talking about, I guess, just mid-air plane turnarounds and what's happened and how you informed and how it all played out. Chris is in Essendon. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. What happened to you?
The family, so husband, myself and our daughter, who was 9 at the time, were travelling back to Bali from a regional airport in Java. And it was a horrible flight. We were bounced around all over the place. There was lightning, no food service. And then all of a sudden there was this announcement in Indonesian and the air hostess had a horrible look on her face and she just ran back to the end of the plane and buckled herself in. And we were just holding hands, thinking that it was going down.
Oh, and my God.
We landed in Bali. Oh. We were unaware of the time difference. So we thought we were on an hour and a half flight, but it was an hour long flight. So
what they were, what do you know? It was basically just a word, prepare for landing type thing announcement.
Yeah.
And you were like, prepare for a crash.
Yeah. So we were there, you know, eyes tearing up, trying to be controlled and brave, no terror and all this for our daughter. And at the end of the day, the plane lands and everybody else just gets up as though nothing else has happened. And
the three of you are sitting there mildly freaking out.
Yeah. So interesting anecdote. When we got our luggage, we got three bags. We only got two of the three bags. And that were the two bags that had all the dirty clothes in it. And the bag that had all the good stuff had been lost. But, yeah,
oh,
we survived.
Oh, no, goodness me. I can just imagine what would have been going through your mind. That's just terrifying. How's your daughter with flying now?
Oh, she's been anywhere and everywhere.
Okay. Yeah, all right, good.
She's got the...
Hold her back.
No. She's... I think South America and Antarctica are the only continents she hasn't got
onto
yet.
Oh, my goodness. Maybe it's because of how well you handled yourself in that situation, Chris, hey?
Yeah. It's currently dry Werribee Hoppers Cross as well.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Good.
That's okay.
Good on you. Thank you. I've got lots of this. Chris, thank you. That would have been horrifying but brilliant all at the same time. Ed Gannon, editor of ABC Wimmera and Swan Hill. I wanted to touch on a story that you and your team have looked at, which is on the ABC's website, around the rise of diesel sales. So we would expect in a world where we're moving towards electric vehicles to see petrol and diesel go down. So petrol is going down, but diesel is going up. Why?
Yeah, well, this story started because I was driving around looking at petrol station signs and I'm thinking, I just don't see the E10 sign as frequently as I used to. So I actually started to research and I found these figures that the Federal Department of Transport releases, and they've released them for the last 15 years. No one's reported on it. So I did some calculations. Diesel's up, last 15 years, diesel's up 48%.
48%?
Yeah, LPG's down 87%. E10's down 44%, and the premium, their 98 premium, is up 67%. Now, the diesel, the major reason, and I spoke to the experts on this, and one of the main reasons they picked is that the amount of home deliveries we do for online shopping.
And Are you serious?
And if you stop and think about all the little vans and all the little trucks, I've been told that the registration has gone up like about number of new trucks and small vans is up by about 1 million in the last sort of 3 or 4 years. Just incredible. And if you actually take, particularly in the morning, if you stand on a busy road and watch the amount of those little vans and trucks.
Those mid-size.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The other day I was walking along and I was looking to take a photo of one of the vans and one just popped straight in front of me and a bloke got out in the high vis and ran across the road and delivered and got back in. The whole time the van was sitting there running the whole time, and then he got back in. That would be happening thousands of times across Melbourne, Victoria, Australia. And then when you stop and think about thinking, actually, that makes sense. And as you say, we're meant to be going down.
Mm.
And the E10 sales is the one that, which is the environmentally conscious one because it's got ethanol in it, it's the one going down as well. So it doesn't.
So if you think about all those online purchases, whether it be our groceries or the, gosh, I mean, we get anything and everything delivered,
yep,
and they're quite often delivered,
yep,
the same day. Sometimes, yep, we think we're being more ethical or we're being more sustainable by not driving ourselves. However, it does have a huge impact because it has to arrive from someone, and how far and how long that's taking to travel. But to have a 48% increase, and that being, yeah, one of the key reasons behind, we really do need to think about our footprint here.
Yeah, it's been because once upon a time a truck would deliver from a warehouse centre to a shop. We would go to the shop, but we'd buy a number of things. Quite often we're getting one item coming. I mean, just a look at the case study of our house, the amount of one things that just turn up, and things that you could put in your pocket,
mm,
would take a truck to have driven, you know, 20 km.
Yeah, I know. I knew someone who got a Mars bar delivered.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, seriously.
Yeah, I mean, and that sort of stuff happens. The drop in E10, a little bit to do that with hybrid vehicles, big surge in hybrid vehicles. We're talking sort of 46% increase in hybrid vehicles in the last 12 months, 54% increase, wow, in electric vehicles. That has it. And the premium, the 98 premium, which I don't think I've ever bought myself, people are feeling there because they spend less money on petrol, they're putting better petrol,
better quality
in their car, in their hybrids.
Well, so that story's online. Ed, thank you. I think I'm going to pay attention now to all of those trucks and just start to count them. Ed Gannon, one of our editors in the ABC Wimmera and Swan Hill area. Thank you, Ed. Matt's in Ballarat. Matt, if you're really quick before we hit the news, we've been talking about mid-air emergencies. What happened to you?
Yeah, hi there. Yeah, this is going back to 1990 when the Berlin Wall was falling. I went to Europe with a friend and we went to Honolulu first, and then we were flying from Honolulu to Los Angeles. We fueled up in Los Angeles and then we were meant to make it to Gatwick and we never made it there. I remember it was night time and I was looking at the big TV screen on the wall.
Mm.
And we were 33,000 feet. And then all of a sudden, water started dripping everywhere in the plane.
Oh, my.
And all down the inside of the windows. It started getting really hot and stuffy. And apparently, we lost cabin pressure and the oxygen tank. And the seatbelt sign came on. The hostesses ran and sat down. And the plane just dived from 33,000 feet to under, I think it was about 13, 14,000 feet. Everyone screamed, everything went everywhere. And there was no warning, no nothing from the pilot. And this was when Pan Am was taken over by United, United Airways.
Wow.
Anyway.
Yeah, and so you made it okay, obviously, Matt.
No, we ended up dropping into Denver, Colorado. Then the airport was snowed in. And we had a 40-hour wait to get on another plane to get to Gatwick.
I would not have wanted to have got on that next plane, Matt. I am so impressed that you managed to do that. Matt, we're about to hit the news. I'm so glad you're okay, though. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Until then, take care. Speak soon.